Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
First one chomped its way through Los Angeles and touched America's hearts. The second one took a bite of the Big Apple and broke the internet before breaking the internet was even a thing. Now, the biggest one yet is about to devour the entire East Coast.
I think we're going to start calling it the Feast Coast.
That's right. While those other movies wait years, even decades, to release sequels, we give the people what they want as soon as it's sort of ready.
Not again.
Sharks as Tornadoes, Part 3, flying to you this Wednesday. We'll talk about that and grown-up cartoons in this week's TV segment with Linda Holmes. First, maybe you wouldn't have been surprised to see some flying sharks during this weekend's crazy weather. It still feels a bit like Florida outside. Well, this weekend, Los Angeles saw record rainfall for July. And that meant, of course, flooding and general infrastructure problems, from power outages to delayed flights at LAX. So with an El Nino predicted for this winter with its heavy rain, what do we need to do to prepare? Jean-Pierre Bardet is here now. He specializes in water infrastructure at the University of Texas Arlington. Before that, he was here at USC for nearly three decades. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, why is it that Los Angeles has such a hard time dealing with water on those few occasions when it really rains? Because when it really rains here, it pours.
Well, it's not the first time. If we look back at history, 1938 was a very bad year for Los Angeles. They had massive floods. More than 100 people died. About 5,000 buildings were destroyed. And cars were inundated. So there was a bad year. And in the wake of that 1938 floods, LA actually developed an extensive infrastructure to deal with the flooding, flash flood included, mm-hmm. and built all these dams. So, but apparently the force of the events, recent events, was such that it was not part of the design of what we have seen in 1938.
Yeah, well, so the LA River is designed to do that, to be a flood control channel, to get rid of the water as fast as possible. Does it do a good job of that?
Well, depends which point of view do you look. You consider a lot of people would like to see a real river, not a concrete U-line, U-shaped channels. And actually, all these channels, it's in Los Angeles, have been built after the 1938 to divert the fast-running water from the public. And the water in L.A. is running so fast, actually, that you can see the plume of dirty water thrown into the ocean from the space. So it's a massive flush each time we have rain in Los Angeles. All these channels are basically channeling the water toward the ocean at very high speed.
Is part of the problem, at least in this particular occurrence, that it hasn't rained in so long, and so the ground is so dry that it can't absorb the water?
Absolutely right. After an extended period of drought, usually the top layers of soils are getting very, forming a crust, impervious crust, and they don't absorb water as much. Therefore, the runoffs, the water, the rainfalls are moving on the ground surface much faster and accumulate much faster and create those flash floods.
Okay, so given that many scientists are predicting an El Nino for this winter, which means a lot of rain, what do you think LA should do to prepare?
Well, my first thought would be to look back at the design. What have we done? The design in the 1930s, 40s, are they sufficient to brace, against the forthcoming rainfalls, which might be much stronger due to global climate change? So we have to kind of think about revising our infrastructures. Is it strong enough at this moment to resist the new forthcoming weather due to climate change? That's a question I think we should look at carefully.
Yeah, and what infrastructure in particular?
Well, basically, everything which is handling the storm water is either the storm water, the everything which capture basically the water, the rainfalls, and also to look at critical infrastructures or the bridges, particular bridges, could some bridges be or some buildings be vulnerable to this sudden increase in rainfall? So there is some homework to be done in view of the size of the infrastructure in Los Angeles.
Yeah, so we saw that bridge on the 10 east of Palm Springs just going out because of the water, and it didn't seem like it was that much rain, really.
Well, it could be that, again, we had a surprising event after a long period of drought. The ground was not able to soak, and all the water basically ran off at the surface and created a very rapid accumulation of storm water and creating a flash flood much stronger than anticipated.
And what do you think homeowners could do to prepare?
Ooh, this is a difficult question. I think it's there are some precautions you can take at the individual level, but a flood is usually a global phenomenon. It's not when an homeowner are caught in the middle of a flood, there is not much they can do except evacuation and following the order of the emergency services.
So sandbags, at least, or some kind of rainwater capture, or is that just tilting at windmills?
Well, it would work, as I said. In some cases, it may just decrease the effect of floods. But if the floods are severe, best thing, I think, is evacuation.
Okay. Jean-Pierre Bardet, director of the Urban Water Institute at the University of Texas Arlington. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, our apocalyptic weekend began on Friday when people had to abandon their cars on the freeway, the 15, because a brush fire was bearing down on them. You could see the cars on fire on live television, captured by news helicopters. But there were other aircraft checking out the scene, which were actually getting in the way of firefighting planes, private drones. Here's San Bernardino County Fire Department Battalion Chief Mark Peebles on NBC.
We saw that fire blow over that freeway. We saw those cars catch fire, those semi-tractor trailers, those boats. It quickly blew over the freeway and quickly got into the vegetation and quickly spread to over 3,500 acres. And so to those drone pilots out there, please stay out of our airspace.
Well, it seems like common sense to keep your drone out of harm's way, but this is the fifth time in a month that this has happened. Keith Kaplan is CEO of the Tesla Foundation and the interim CEO of the Unmanned Autonomous Vehicle System Association. That's a commercial drone association. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm fine, thanks. Well, apparently, from what I've heard, the firefighting planes had to be grounded for more than 20 minutes because the drones were in their way. So it seems like, as I said, common sense that the drones shouldn't be in this airspace during an emergency. So why don't people know better?
Actually, no aircraft are allowed to be in an emergency management situation. And that I think part of the issue is that people need to understand that these are aircraft. And it's very, very important. And I think that everyone in the private sector, as well as different emergency management groups and the government, is starting to address the fact that aerorobotics and this type of technology brings a tremendous amount of promise. But it's also going to bring a tremendous amount of issue for education, much like when automobiles were first introduced. You know, we had pedestrians and animals and horse-drawn, different types of transportation kind of mixed in a little bit with rail. And we had to have a physical person down the road about an eighth of a mile waving red flags saying there was a horseless carriage coming. So there are a lot of challenges as far as public awareness and education. But the most important thing is to realize that this is an aircraft.
So what happens to the owner of these aircraft when they do fly them into an emergency?
Well, it is completely illegal, and if they're caught, they'll get a tremendous fine. Not only if it's something that local authorities are interested in becoming involved with, but also on a federal level, the FAA will ground them and issue them a very, very hefty fine, actually for each violation. And it's a very big deal to understand that this is a right. The freedom of flight is a right that we have as citizens. And if you abuse this, it's going to become something that might be taken away. So it would be very, very important for people to understand that this is something that is just like getting a pilot's license or a driver's license. It's something that you're allowed to do because there's been a lot of work by a lot of people to plan how this is possible. But if you abuse this, it's something that can be taken away from you.
So is this just a matter of people not knowing what the rules are, or are they actually flouting them on purpose?
I personally believe they don't know the rules. And this is a huge issue. And this is one of the things that we also saw at the dawn of the computer age when we were at the homebrew club inflection point for computing as it became something that again, became available to the public because of cost. The people need to know the rules of flight with an aircraft. So there's a tremendous amount of public awareness and education that needs to happen. The reason that the FAA requires a pilot's license right now when you acquire a 333 application for commercial use, exemption for commercial use of a drone, is that they need to assure those that would be insuring and also hiring these individuals that they understand the rules of flight the way that a pilot does. It is in works right now, and the UAVSA is part of an education coalition that's involved with providing this education and training and going to be assisting the FAA in doing this. It's paramount that you understand the rules of flight, basic understanding of airspace, right-of-way, weather conditions, same type of things that a person would need to know for a manned aircraft, but you are flying an unmanned aircraft.
So actually, what are they doing flying those drones there? Are people trying to get footage and then sell it to news stations, or what are they doing there?
That I don't know. Personally, I think it's dumb people doing dumb things. And unfortunately, that can mess up a lot of very valuable and fun activities for other people.
Are there ways that these drones can be helpful? Can they be used to help fight fires?
They're tremendously helpful, and they're actually being used by emergency management services for many different types of things today. And most importantly, I think situational awareness when they're in coordination with manned and unmanned aircraft. Also, they use robotics on the ground so that they don't put human beings in harm's way in different types of environments. The benefit of robotics and aerorobotics as we move forward is tremendous. And obviously, you know, we have Facebook today, but the long-term view is that we will have transportation pods at different altitudes. And as we integrate this type of technology, people need to respect and educate themselves with the fact that this is a right, like driving a vehicle. And it also involves education and training, like operating an aircraft or any type of a motorized vehicle.
And finally, do you think that we need stricter laws? There's some legislation making its way through the Capitol in Sacramento that would make it a criminal offense to interfere with firefighting in this way.
I'm not going to comment on what the legislators are proposing. I believe that there are many laws that already exist on the books. A, you can't fly your plane or your helicopter into emergency management situation, period. There's a 15, just by default, there's a 15-mile no-fly zone around an emergency management situation. So that law is on the books. And there's also lots of privacy laws that are on the books. And these laws need to be respected the same way that you would see these same types of scenarios for a helicopter or a small private plane or a commercial aircraft, for that matter, at different types of scenarios. So these laws already exist. We've been through this type of a process with aircraft. Now we have to apply these same types of rules, principles, and knowledge to these unmanned aircraft.
Q Keith Kaplan is interim CEO of the Unmanned Autonomous Vehicle System Association. That's a commercial drone association. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, why getting a yearly mammogram may actually harm your health. That story is next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Breast cancer screenings may be doing more harm than good. That's according to a new study by researchers at Dartmouth and Harvard. The study finds that the practice of early screening in place since the 1980s has led to overdiagnosis, overtreatment, and a whole lot of unnecessary anxiety for women who get mammograms. And most importantly, the authors say the rise of early screening has done nothing to reduce cases of deadly late-stage breast cancer. Joining us now is the lead researcher on that study. H. Gilbert Welch is a professor of medicine at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, according to your research, early stage breast cancer detection has really skyrocketed since mammograms at age 40 became a thing. And one would think that that's a good thing. Early detection leads to early treatment and early prevention, but your study found not so.
Yeah, it's one of the unusual aspects for people to consider is that finding more breast cancer isn't necessarily going to be in the interest of women. It turns out that the early forms of cancer that can be found by mammography that will ultimately never appear in a woman's lifetime clinically. And so this is why people are asking questions about the value of looking hard for early forms of cancer. And what we did is we just looked at the 547 counties that report to the federal government's major tumor registry and asked the question of how aggressively is screening penetrated in those counties. Some counties screen a lot more than others. And what we found is that the counties that screen more definitely find more breast cancer. But they have a similar rate of mortality as counties that screen less. So it looks like from the population level, the primary effect of screening is to tell more women they have breast cancer, leads to more treatment, without having an obvious effect on their rate of death or the rate at which they present with the feared form of the disease, the advanced breast cancers.
But I guess the question for a woman who gets a positive test result in an early screening is they don't know whether or not that's going to turn into something.
Absolutely. The question here, I think, for women is to what extent do they want to participate in this effort? And I think my major message is that screening is a choice. It's not a public health imperative. I think we've exaggerated its benefits and we've downplayed its harms.
Okay, so talk a little bit about the harms. What's wrong with getting early screening?
Well, they really fall in three categories. One is the general anxiety related to breast cancer that really is an artifact of promoting screening. And I'm talking about pictures of young women developing breast cancer with on the back of my Cheerios box. The average age was 31, when in fact the average age of breast cancer diagnosis in this country is 61. So you get exaggerated perception of risk. The second is the false alarm problem. In this country, a woman undergoing mammography each year for 10 years has about a 50% chance of having at least one false alarm. Now, to be fair, this ranges from a simple second mammogram that then tells you, the original mammogram was wrong, to a series of multiple repeated tests, which never say you have cancer, but also never say you're normal. And most countries in the rest of the world would never accept this kind of false positive rate of 50%. In most European countries, it would be more around 20% for a 10-year course.
Wow.
And then the most unfamiliar harm is being diagnosed with breast cancer, treated for breast cancer, a cancer that would otherwise never become apparent to you during your lifetime. And these are focused certainly on the earliest forms of breast cancer, particularly the ductal carcinoma in situ, which some pathologists wish they never used the word carcinoma with, but also include some of the local invasive breast cancers, which appear to be much more frequently found by mammography than they would be if nothing was done at all. So I want to emphasize that women who feel good about mammography and want to continue it, that's a perfectly reasonable choice. But this is a close call, and women who don't feel good about it and feel they've gotten caught in cycles of endless testing can feel equally good about not pursuing it.
You said that there's only a 20% of false alarms in Europe compared to a 50% chance here. Why do they have such a lower rate?
Well, I think ironically, one of the problems with breast cancer screening in this country is we're looking too hard. And to be fair to the mammography community, they're under great pressure to look for abnormalities, and they feel they're punished only in one direction. They're punished if they don't find something. They're never punished for finding too many things. While an organized program of screening, and really in our country, it's really a haphazard program. There's no effort to try to gauge exactly what's happening across the country in our program. But an organized screening program will really look and make sure that not too much of the population is being alarmed for a disease which most people won't get. I mean, one of the realities of screening is you have to involve a lot of people to potentially help a few. And we're talking about numbers like you have to involve about 1,000 people maybe to help one. And the question that becomes relevant is what happens to the other 999?
So what is the, I mean, we do hear these 1 in 9 statistics, and it's pretty scary. So, what is the rate of breast cancer?
Well, isn't that an interesting question? Ironically, mammography has made breast cancer more common. Because it can find small tumors that otherwise would never appear. So some of what you hear in that 1 in 9 statistic, which is a lifetime risk for being diagnosed with cancer, is inflated because of mammography.
Hmm. So I don't know if it's possible to tease this out, but of all the cancers, you know, how do you know which ones are the ones that will end up being deadly or not?
Well, we're working on that. I mean, and some of it is about characteristics of the tumor. Some of it's about its size. Some of it's about its genetics. Some of it's about the individual involved. But one of the things that I think every woman should understand is there's very good news in breast cancer. The breast cancer mortality rate has fallen by 30% over the last 20 years. That's a huge advance. And that reflects better treatment. We've really gotten a lot better at treatment. We've gotten better able to characterize which tumors, for example, are hormone receptor positive or negative. We've been able to initiate adjuvant chemotherapy and hormonal therapy. There have been real advances in breast cancer treatment. And ironically, the better we're able to treat breast cancer, the less important early detection becomes.
All right. So what should women do then? Should they forego the early mammogram beginning at age
40? No, I think women should understand this is a very close call. It's been oversold. And they should understand that it's not always in their interest to look harder for cancer. And there are, of course, many commercial interests here. This has become a big business. And, you know, mammography is not enough. It's got to be 3D mammography. That will find more cancer. Or you add an ultrasound, that finds more cancer. You add an MRI, that finds more cancer. And now people are talking about molecular breast imaging. But that can't be the right direction to go. We're already finding too many cancers. So the best test isn't the one that finds the most cancer, and that sometimes looking less hard may actually be in women's best interest.
Dr. H. Gilbert Welch, Professor of Medicine at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. Has your doctor insisted on a yearly mammogram, changed his or her policy? What do you do? What's your opinion on this? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the show, writer and comedian Danny Klein-Modisette on comedy and marriage and how to make it all work.
I do think that being a comedian doesn't really lend itself to teamwork.
That's next, after a news update with KCRW's Jennifer Wolfe.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Marriage is a perennial for comedians. Every comic can rely on laughs for lines like these.
Here's what happens. When you get married, you go, holy I can't leave now. Then you have a kid and you go, holy I could have left.
Marriage, I'm telling you something, marriage is a job. I wish somebody had explained that to me.
Hi, I'm Jen. I'm divorced. Divorce is a legal term for no one's farted in my bed for 3 years.
Nothing gets you ready for marriage, man. Nothing, nobody, nothing gets you ready for marriage.
Funny on stage, but try that at home? Well, you'll probably get crickets. That's certainly what comedian Danny Klein-Modisette was up against recently. She and her husband, they were fighting a lot, and there were not a lot of laughs. But she knew that laughter is one of the keys to a successful marriage. And so she looked for a self-help book that would tell her just how to bring back the humor to her relationship. Well, there wasn't one, so she wrote one. It's called Take My Spouse, Please, How to Keep Your Marriage Happy, Healthy, and Thriving by Following the Rules of Comedy. And Danny Klein-Modisette is here now to share those rules. Hi.
Hi.
So here you are, a professional comedian.
Yes.
And you're not having any fun in your marriage?
No, that was true. 10
we're
years
not
ago.
Laughing.
Or it wasn't exactly 10 years ago. It was like 4 years ago. But yes, no, we were not laughing.
It's not now.
It's not now. Now we're laughing. I laughed on the way over here. But no, then we weren't laughing. We were going through a very bad time. It was a, there's something about anniversaries too. And this was like the 10-year mark. And I think there's a lot of expectation around that. Mm-hmm. And we were not living up to it at all. And I just remember we were at this hotel. It sounds like Core Reasons. I'm not going to say the name of the hotel. And it was like a special 2-for-1 weekend. And we were, you know, doing our best. But the thing is that the 2-for-1 was labeled double the fun. So every time you did anything at the hotel, the person would come over and say, are you here for double the fun? Are you here for double? And we were completely morose. There was no doubling our fun. There was 2x0. It was not going to happen. So it was just like it was a bad time. And that's when I thought, oh, I need some help.
You need some help. And you looked around and you couldn't find it. But then you thought, well, gosh, I teach comedy.
Yes.
I know the rules of comedy.
Well, beyond that, it's that everybody tells you as a comedian, oh, stand-up, that's the hardest thing in the world to do. That's the hardest thing in the world to do. And I was like laying in my bed thinking, not really. I think maybe marriage is a little harder.
Yeah.
Like, you know, stand-up, it's like it's over in an hour. Maybe this is endless. I mean, it could be feel endless is what I mean, honey, if you're listening.
I was going to say, what have you learned?
Yes. No, it's definitely something that it's possible to laugh in your marriage as well. With a little effort,
well,
a little bit of effort.
Yeah, but, you know, there are lots of stressors in a marriage, especially as you, you know, after the rosy, what, 2 or 3 years, the first 2 or 3 years, it's all great. And then it gets kind of like,
really? Is that 2 or 3 years? Oh, we had a very short span of rosy. But that's because we had a baby very quickly.
Right. So yeah, there's the kid factor,
yeah,
which changes everything.
Totally.
So you decide, okay, I teach comedy at UCLA. I've got these comedy rules.
Because people had said that was the hardest thing, I thought, well, let me just look. Kind of on a whim. Just let me just look at my syllabus. I taught a 12-week course at UCLA in the extension program. I was like, I bet there's things in there that could help this other hardest thing to do in life. Like, there's got to be. And sure enough, as I started to go through it, I kind of like had to laugh. I mean, which is good, you know, because it was showing up and listening and letting go of a bad night and paying attention to timing and the element of surprise and surrounding yourself with positive, happy people with the same goals that you have, which, you know, uh-huh, in this case, to stay married. And so I was kind of amazed. And then from there, I decided to explore it more fully.
And did you explore it more fully with the purpose of trying to save your marriage?
Oh, I definitely think, I mean, save is a big word because,
well, you know
make but
it
yes, but
better.
Definitely to improve it and definitely to stop being miserable. I mean, because there's a distinction between.
Sounds like saving your marriage.
Right. Oh, yeah, it probably does. Thank you. That's that's why you're the host. Yes, exactly. Because I wanted to be happily married.
Yeah.
I think we wanted to be happily married. And so that was the goal. And we had small children and neither of us were going anywhere. And so that created the intention to figure out how to do it better than I was doing it.
Okay. So one of the rules you said is basically listening to your audience, paying attention.
Sure.
And
yes.
You have a really good anecdote where one of your students is doing stand-up and he's completely ignoring this incident that's happening
oh,
in
yes.
the audience,
yes.
which is so funny.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah. Well,
yes.
It is. But it really makes the point that he is so intent on pursuing his act that he refuses to deal with
what's in the room.
Yeah.
Which is so common. I mean, it's so translatable to any marital situation where you're so focused on what you want to communicate or what you need or what happened in your day that you're not even listening to the other person. Or you're so, I mean, it could be as simple as you're so busy with your face and your smartphone that you're not present. So, and you miss so much. And that's the thing, just like a comedy audience, when someone's doing their material and they're going to do that material, whether an earthquake hits or not,
mm-hmm.
you're not fulfilling, as a comic, you're not fulfilling what I paid for, which is for someone to do something spontaneous and in the moment. That's the price of admission, is that you're going to do something or say something that I don't have the courage to do and I would never be able to do. And you're missing that. The magic will not be in the room. So, and that's, again, like the laughter, like what I'm talking about, you know, we're looking for the magic to be back in the room.
Yeah. And you're looking for spontaneity. And oftentimes, you know, when you're getting into your second decade of marriage, things aren't so spontaneous.
Well, you do kind of know, you can begin to know the ins and outs. You can anticipate a reaction and not even give the person a chance to be in the moment, not really listen to what they are really saying, because like, oh, I know what she's going to say to that. Or, you know, I know what he's going to do. And then you're missing. You're not giving each other the opportunity to reinvent, as it were.
Or maybe you've just heard the same stories and the same anecdotes and the same.
Yeah, well, Chris Rock has a hysterically funny joke that opens one of the chapters about that.
Yeah, why do you stop talking? Because at some point you have heard everything this person has to say, and it makes you sick to your stomach. You know what they gonna say before it even comes out their mouth, and you just want to stab them in the neck with a pencil.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Danny Klein-Modisette, author of a new book called Take My Spouse, Please, How to Keep Your Marriage Happy, Healthy, and Thriving by Following the Rules of Comedy. When you're talking about comedians and their magic on stage, you often assume that they're kind of miserable human beings off stage, that they don't have good relationships.
Well, I do think that being a comedian doesn't really lend itself to teamwork. And that was something that I really came to the marriage with, that obstacle, because you're on your own. You're a one man band. I did whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted to. My life was designed that way. And now I was in a partnership, and you have to think as a team and begin to really consider and collaborate. And I mean, this is the fork in the road between, you know, the rules for comedians and the rules for marriage. Marriage really involves collaboration and communication, of course, but real collaboration. It's a give and take. And really the only give and take you have as a stand-up comic is you and the audience. And it's kind of a limited run. You know, you're responsive.
Well, you're in control.
Yes,
right?
And you are in control.
And you're in power.
Yes, and yes. If anybody really bothers you, you can have someone remove them from the room, which I don't think you can do in a marriage. I don't think that would be very successful.
Well, no, but as an audience member, I'm a little afraid of the comedian on stage that they're going to, you know, single me out and do what you do.
Oh, well, that's just you then. Some people, that's why they go.
They want to be single.
Oh, yeah. Well, they want to get in the game. You know, they want the adrenaline rush.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but yes, some people.
But do you find that after you do a night on stage that you have to completely change or change your whole being when you get home?
Oh, that's such a great question, because I think that I do. I think that I come off and I'm like so full of adrenaline and like work in a room and and as you said, like in control of the room. And then I get home and like my husband's watching TV on the couch. He's very quiet and, you know, the dog's next to him and like the kids are, you know, fighting about who's going to brush their teeth, and suddenly I can't control any of it, and nobody's doing what I want them to do, and they don't actually think I'm that special. It's just
Do they think you're funny?
Oh yeah, they do think I'm funny. They do. My kids really, they laugh.
Does your husband think you're funny?
He can. He can. He's a very tough critic. I mean, the beauty of my husband is that he allowed, for lack of a better word, me to expose our marriage in this way, because there's a lot of personal stories in the book. But and that's terrific. He's not afraid of anything. He's totally open to whatever the truth is. He just needs it to be funny.
When you're talking about humor and bringing humor into the marriage and humor at home, you're not talking about sarcasm.
No, I'm not. Actually, I go into
that
this.
That is actual hostility.
True and destructive. That cutting sarcastic stuff will not do anything good for your marriage.
All right, let's talk about a rule. I don't know if it's a rule of comedy, but it's definitely a rule of marriage. And it's the three-letter rule.
The three-letter rule?
I'm referring to the word sex.
Oh, well, okay. Yes, so sex. Sex is to marriage what jokes are to an audience. You know, without it, people get restless. And I really have found that to be true, not just personally, but in all. I interviewed 100 at least long-term couples married 14 to 60 plus years, and everyone talked about the need for physical intimacy to be happy. What else can I say about sex? Have it.
Often.
Often. And have it often. And with each other. Yeah,
not
that's
with
another
someone
key.
Else.
Yes, yes. That is definitely a key point. Have it.
Well, you do talk
marriage.
About that there is the idea of straying, and you interview a rabbi who says, well, if you do, don't say anything.
Yeah. That was a profound moment to be sitting in a rabbi's chambers and hear that. But I go into more detail and context about who he is and why he would have said that. But I did think it was interesting. And I talked to a lot of long-term couples who nodded their head yes. Like if it's a one-night kind of diversion or what a slip or whatever you want to call it, is it really worth jeopardizing your marriage? Now, I don't think I agree with this, honestly. And I, you know, I think if a tree drops its pants in the woods, like it dropped its pants, you know, whether anybody heard it or not. Like it's not a good, it creates a fissure in honesty. So I can't be a proponent of that. But I'm so far of what I know, I haven't experienced that. Like that's not my experience or my husband's so far that I know.
Who knows about that?
Right.
That tree.
Right. Who knows about the tree? And I just think what would be awful is to find out some other way. That would be, you know, the killer.
So, okay, after you've done all this, you've synthesized your rules and interviewed a bunch of people,
yes.
experts and long-term couples. Mm-hmm. What have you come away with in terms of your own marriage? And how did you, what did you apply to it? But maybe one of these rules that you found the most helpful.
Oh, so easy. So the most important thing, which was a huge epiphany for me, was you do not have to say the first thing that comes into your mind to your spouse. Like crazy, you know, as a comedian, that's what, as I said earlier, like
right,
that's
because you're trying to riff and you're being spontaneous.
Oh, totally, that's the goal.
Yeah.
Apparently not so much in a marriage. That first, you know, crazy thought that you have about the other person or situation or, you know, tapping into your authentic rage about something, you know, really great for stand-up, not very good for marriage. Like that, you know, think for a minute. And it was something that Lou Schneider, the comedy writer Lou Schneider, said to me about, you know, you never regret what you didn't say. You can only regret the things that you did say. And it really stuck with me. And it has affected how I communicate with Todd. I don't need to say that first thing. Like, think about it. Think it through. Stop. Take a breath. Michael Latimer, one of the therapists I spoke with, he actually counsels people. Take a time out. Mm. Literally, set a timer. Because if you don't, you might just take a time off.
You know, a long-term time off.
Right.
But that goes to timing and comic timing.
Yes.
And knowing your audience and knowing when to stop and knowing when to forge ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Which is a big part of marriage, too. The timing. You know, that whole idea of when to say something. Don't talk about taxes during The Walking Dead. You know, it's not, don't ruin that moment. Like, be conscious, be sensitive.
Danny Klein-Modisette, author of the book, Take My Spouse, Please. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Warren Olney, you're on stage.
I love your last interview. It sounds a lot like what I hear when I go home.
Is your wife as funny as Danny?
Very wise. Sometimes.
Yes.
Sometimes. We are going to be talking about, remember the Iran nuclear deal?
It's
going to be with us for a long time to come. And the UN Security Council today approved it. We're going to hear what that means for the Congress and get some very, very interesting different viewpoints on what its prospects are and, you know, what it might mean and just what the kind of dissent that we have, partisan dissent in the United States on a foreign policy matter, what that might mean in the future for America's leadership in the world.
Mm, okay, important discussion coming up at 1 o'clock here on KCRW with Warren Olney. And to the point, coming up on this show, well, we're going to go in an opposite direction because it's Christmas in July. Sharknado 3 this week, plus other TV highlights. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Bradwell. Cancel your plans for Wednesday night. You're staying in because it's round three of Sharknado.
That's right. While those other movies wait years, even decades to release sequels, we give the people what they want as soon as it's sort of ready.
Not again.
Not again. Sharknado 3, Oh Hell No, debuts Wednesday night on the Sci-Fi Channel. And here to talk about that cultural highlight, as well as other TV news, is Linda Holmes. She writes and edits NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See, and she hosts the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Hi there.
Hello.
Well, did you see 1 and 2?
I did see 1 and 2. I did.
Yes. You don't have to whisper. It's not shameful. You've all been there.
No, of course it's not. Of course it's not. I mean, it's one of those things where people have really embraced whatever shamefulness there is. And I think once you embrace the shame, then it kind of ceases to be shame.
Yeah. So is this something that people just enjoy laughing at and tweeting about?
Yes. I can't really explain to you why, out of all the ones like this that Sci-Fi has done, why it wasn't Piranaconda or one of the other variations on this, but for some reason it was Sharknado, that became the one where they really just steered into the skid of how goofy it is. These movies have always been kind of tongue-in-cheek, but they weren't overtly tongue-in-cheek. And this one is kind of, this one has obviously gotten to the point now where they're treating it like a comedy, as opposed to treating it like a B-movie, which is kind of what they were doing with the other ones.
So what has it done for the actors in this? I mean, you have Tara Reid, not exactly an A-lister, starring in it. And now I hear that Ann Coulter, who's, well, I guess she's not an actress, maybe some people think she is, but she's playing the vice president in this.
It is the weirdest phenomenon how this started, because Tara Reid and Ian Ziering, who was on Beverly Hills 90210 back in the day, shout out to Steve Sanders, started out as the leads of this movie when, you know, being the lead in a movie like this was a very kind of low status job. And then by the second one, a bunch of the cameos were people where you'd start to be like, oh, Will Wheaton's in this. Oh, you know, Al Roker's in this. And it started to kind of bubble up where getting a cameo in Sharknado went from being something that you would see not as a very competitive thing to something where now you really get the feeling that getting a cameo in Sharknado, I mean, you know, you don't want to be acting in Sharknado, but you do want a cameo in Sharknado.
I'm really waiting for Trump to be in the next one. Okay, well, speaking of cartoonish television, the cartoons for adult segment seems to be stronger than ever. So it's not just The Simpsons or Adult Swim anymore. Netflix now has BoJack Horseman. The second season premiered on Friday, and here's a clip.
BoJack Horseman is our guest tonight.
Okay, sorry. I'm pretty f***ed up right now.
Who loves it, boy?
Well, that was another in a long series of regrettable life choices.
Okay, so BoJack, played by Will Arnett. Also Amy Sedaris in this, Alison Brie, and Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad. So it sounds like a pretty interesting cast.
Everyone is in this. Everyone is in this. Paul F. Tompkins is in this. Everyone is in this. The general gist of BoJack Horseman is that it takes place, it's an animated show that takes place in a world where people and animals are living together and interacting as people would with other people. And then BoJack Horseman himself is a former sitcom star. He starred in a 90s family sitcom called, I believe, Horsin' Around, which was kind of like Full House slash My Two Dads, if the dad was a horse.
And he's an alcoholic, and he's a womanizer, and he's just a general
bad dude. But in the end of the first season on Netflix, it took on this weird tone of melancholy and actually became about the sadness of a middle-aged being dealing with, you know, your idea of your own relevance, and it's really a hard show to explain.
Oh my gosh, paging Matthew Weiner.
It's a really hard show to explain.
Sounds a little like Mad Men, huh?
It is. You know, my theory of Netflix is that Netflix still, even in its original programming, carries remnants of its origins as a virtual video store, because where you look at a network like HBO or FX or some of the others, you see them trying to come up with at least one idea of what their programming is at a time. HBO really broke out with a certain kind of drama and a certain kind of comedy and built a brand on that. Netflix operates much more like a video store. They have an adult cartoon. They have regular sitcoms like Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. They have comedy specials. They have dramas like House of Cards. Mm. They're much more like a video store and much less like a channel with a single brand.
So put on your critic's hat for a second. Do you like BoJack Horseman?
I do like BoJack Horseman. It's, you know, I think there are people who are hugely enthusiastic consumers of adult cartoons, whether it's, you know, Archer or, you know, in the old days, Frisky Dingo was one on Comedy Central. There are people whose thing that is. It's not quite my thing as much as it is for some, but it's a show that's really, thoughtful, at the same time, really goofy, and that mm-hmm. can be a very difficult balance to strike. And the cast is wonderful. The cast is really, really wonderful and varied.
Okay, BoJack Horseman. And okay, finally, let's talk about Dennis Leary back with a show on FX. It's called Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, a mockumentary-style show about an aging rocker trying to get his mojo back.
Yeah.
So why'd the band break up?
His ego.
Your ego.
His ego.
Your ego, and you slept with my wife.
Your wife slept with me.
See, he flips it.
No. Okay, if I admit that I slept with your wife after 25 years, will you finally forgive me?
Yeah, did you sleep with my wife?
Yes, I slept with your wife. Do you forgive me?
No.
Okay, Dennis Leary, is he sort of playing himself there?
Well,
I mean, I don't want to comment on his personal life, but...
No, I wouldn't either. I think, you know, the first part of it, as you mentioned, it opens with a short mockumentary segment, but after that, it just becomes kind of one of these comedic dramas, dramatic comedies about this very misanthropic, angry dude, and that's kind of what FX does, middle-aged, misanthropic, angry dudes. And it's kind of peak Dennis Leary and peak FX in a way that for me is a little tired at this point. He can be mesmerizing to watch, but the show is a little played out for me. The idea of you know, can this terrible person find redemption, has lost some of its freshness.
It sounds similar in theme to BoJack.
I mean, they are both formerly famous, who am I now kind of characters. And I think, there's some similarity there. It's a good point.
So maybe if he had a horse's head on or something like that.
Maybe. And, you know, this all kind of ties back to Sharknado, because I think you have some people in Sharknado who are also pondering how their careers have taken them to the point where they are.
Basically, we just need to put animals in every show to save them. Linda Holmes writes and edits NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. Look, there's an animal in your title, and hosts the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Thanks, Linda.
Thank you.
Is here now to welcome in the new week.
I like that deep cut of our music there.
Yes, we're just going to keep on playing and playing.
Cartoons for adults. Yes, please, Madeline.
You're a big fan of.
I am. I really am. That's basically when I sit down to watch TV. It's going to be binging Archer or Bob's Burgers, Team Bob's Burgers forever. And our listeners basically fell into two camps. It was Camp Bob's Burgers and Camp BoJack Horseman, two of the most popular adult cartoons on TV. Brittany Machado is a BoJack Horseman fan. She tweets that there is no other show that makes her laugh, cry, and cringe all in one episode. But Brad Foster tweets that Tina from Bob's Burgers is his spirit animal, and I have to co-sign that. She is such an incredible,
Let me just sum it up with
a sound effect that she gives. No, she's the daughter. She's the oldest daughter on Bob's Burgers. She's constantly going, sort of Marge style, only more nervous. And I love her. We also talked about breast cancer screening on the show today, more serious topic, and about how over-screening and over-diagnosis could be a real problem in women's health. Nisha works in healthcare and says that she sees people go through these kinds of false alarms all of the time. The anxiety that these women go through because of testing is incredibly harmful. People should really think before they test. But Sandra Segal emailed us and said that our segment was outrageous and that her breast cancer was diagnosed through an early test and it saved her life. And she says, what are 1,000 false tests if one woman's life is saved? And that's a real equation for her. So Sandra was outraged by our segment today. If you were outraged or otherwise, please weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you for that, Julie Myers. And we'll see you tomorrow. Warren Olney, To the Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow as well.